wouldn't talk about like anything really in quantum gravity, but more like topics in semi-classical gravity. And this basically is something that I just got interested in very recently, and that like mostly came up in discussions with Abhay Ashtekar. So the topic is Hawking radiation and the link with what we call the effective action formalism. So I'll just like briefly introduce and motivate what I want to talk about. Then I would like to focus on two-dimensional models to sort of introduce the basic elements of the construction and further motivate the problem that I want to look at and to address. And then in the third part, we look at really the interesting four-dimensional case. And then finally, I'll conclude and give some perspectives on what I think can be done in this topic. So the introduction, so as you know, so black hole solutions, so usually we say that black holes have no hair because they are completely characterized by a three-parameter family of solutions, so with mass m, angular momentum j, and charge q. And so what is, of course, very interesting with these black holes is that they possess thermodynamical properties. So it was first noticed by Bekenstein that one should assign an entropy to these black holes, and essentially the entropy that you assign to these black holes is proportional to a quarter of the is proportional to the area. So basically, the area of the horizon divided by four. Then later on, in 1974, Hawking realized that in fact this is not just an analogy, basically with thermodynamics, but it encodes like richer physics, because there's really a sense in which one can understand black holes as emitting a black body, or in fact a gray body radiation. So one can compute this gray body radiation and see that it is a radiation that is at this so-called Hawking temperature, which is here proportional to the surface gravity kappa. And so of course we know now many more things about this thermodynamics of gravity and of black holes in particular. And it turns out that there is a deep analogy between the laws of thermodynamics and the laws of black hole mechanics. So for example, this is written here, the first law of thermodynamics and the first law of black hole mechanics. So of course, one question in this formalism, so if we start talking about thermodynamical properties of black holes, is really what is the origin of the microstates that give these thermodynamical properties to these black holes? So of course, this would be a question to address in quantum gravity, and I don't want to discuss anything related to this today. Rather, I want to talk about more semi-classical properties of these black holes. And so these black holes, they possess this phenomenon of Hawking radiation. So this means that in a finite time, over a very, very long time, these black holes eventually evaporate. So little by little, they start to evaporate. And the physical process in this evaporation is that basically, if one takes a pure state on scry minus, then we end up with a mixed state on scry plus. And so this state is basically the thermal state that describes this Hawking radiation. And so of course this has raised like many, many questions, and there's still like a big controversy as to what the consequences and the interpretation of this should be. And for example, questions related to like the fate of unitarity and information loss problems. And so this has been a lot of work has been dedicated to try to address these issues. So again, I don't want to talk about these issues today. I want to talk about something like more sort of less speculative. And I want to talk just about the calculation of Hawking radiation. So as you know, the original calculation was just done considering quantum fields on a fixed classical black hole geometry. And so since then, there has been many, many sort of improvements of this calculation and many, many alternative derivation of this Hawking effect. So here, I just want to focus on one approach to Hawking radiation, which is exploiting the fact that we can compute the effective stress energy tensor. And we can basically compute this effective stress energy tensor by knowing what we call the conformal anomaly. And so this method was originally pioneered by Christensen and Fulling in 1977. So this is for the moment general. So I want then to show the 2D examples and then try to generalize these to four dimensions. Exactly, that's the whole point of, yeah. Exactly. That's what I want to discuss here, in fact. And so the point of this, basically, is that eventually one would like to improve this calculation of Hawking radiation, because we would like, ultimately, to take into account backscattering, so the fact that these sort of thermal photons that escape from the black hole, they don't see just, they see a potential basically, which is due to this black hole geometry. So this causes some backscattering of these photons as they escape. So we would like to take into account this backscattering. Also, we would like to take into account a back reaction. So the fact that as the black hole evaporates, it's sort of modifying the what would be originally the fixed black hole geometry. And we would like to take into account in the process of this evaporation, the back reaction of Hawking radiation on the geometry itself. And then, of course, what we would like to do ultimately is to have a full quantum gravity description of this, but this is, I don't think, available so far. So one approach to back reaction, basically, so to computing the back reaction of Hawking radiation on the geometry is to use so what people call this semi-classical approach to back reaction. And in this semi-classical picture, the idea is to use the usual Einstein equations, except that we source these Einstein equations with some renormalized stress energy tensor. So we would take these normal Einstein equations, but on the right-hand side, put this effective stress energy tensor. So now we have to ask the question, how is this stress energy tensor defined, in fact? Because this equation looks a bit strange because we're equating something which is like quantum mechanical to something which is purely classical and geometrical. And so people like Wald, for example, in 77, has given a list of axioms and properties that this effective stress energy tensor should satisfy. So in particular, one sees immediately that, so of course, this effective stress energy tensor has to be state dependent. So we have to specify the state in which we take this expectation value. So this effective stress energy tensor also has to be conserved in order to preserve this symmetry of the Einstein equations. So just like the classical stress energy tensor is conserved, we require that the quantum stress energy tensor be also conserved. What we can also require is that this effective stress energy tensor be vanishing when it's evaluated for Minkowski spacetime, so that at least we have one consistent solution of these effective semi-classical Einstein equations. And then there are also like other axioms on top of this, such like there's a causality axiom and something that's called a consistency axiom. And basically, Wald has shown that if one imposes these requirements on this effective stress energy tensor, basically, if we choose two different stress energy tensor, which can come from two different regularization schemes, so from two different renormalization schemes, if they satisfy these axioms, basically they can only differ by a local conserved quantity. So this imposes like a big really restriction on the tip of on the type of effective stress energy tensor that we can construct. So again, the question is which states should we use to compute this expectation value? And I just want to point out that in general, the general form of this effective stress energy tensor is not known, so even for a Schwarzschild black hole. And so the general form is not known unless we have a sufficiently high degree of symmetry for gravity or for the matter fields. So this is what I want to discuss in a moment. So because, in fact, we don't know the general form of this effective stress energy tensor, we can't really address this issue of a back reaction. Because this idea of solving this semi-classical Einstein equation would be to know this effective stress energy tensor for a general enough class of metrics, and then solve self-consistently this semi-classical Einstein equations. So we have to know this stress energy tensor for a general enough class of geometries. Okay. So now I want to discuss briefly a mechanism that enables us, in fact, to some extent, to reconstruct this effective stress energy tensor. And this is due to what people call the Weyl anomaly. So this was discovered in 73 by Kapper and Duff. And the idea is that from the classical point of view, for example, if we consider a conformally invariant, let's say, scalar field, the trace of the energy momentum tensor classically is zero, basically. It's vanishing. And this is due to the Weyl invariance of the action. But what happens is that quantum mechanically, so if we quantize this stress energy tensor and renormalize it in a suitable way, what we get is that the expectation value of the trace of the energy momentum tensor is not vanishing anymore. So this is what we call the Weyl anomaly or the trace anomaly. And basically, for example, in four dimensions, there is this calculation by Desert, Duff, and Isham that shows that so the expectation value of the trace of the energy momentum tensor, so it's not vanishing, but it has the property of being purely geometrical. So it's written uniquely in terms of these geometrical quantities, where C here is the Weyl tensor, and it's also state independent. No, not for the moment, no, yeah. This is just like just the stress tensor itself. Yeah.
What do you mean by state independent?
Yes, yeah, so I will make this precise in a moment. But so this means that literally, for any state in which we can compute the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, the trace will be the same for any state that we can take. So in other words, it means that the state independency of this quantum trace is also reflected in the fact that this quantum trace is local, in fact. So we're going to see that the full effective action is non-local. This means that it depends on the state, as it should be, because we said that the effective stress energy tensor should depend on the state in which we evaluate it. So I'm going to talk in a minute about what these states should be. So let's go to two dimensions to see how this mechanism of trace anomaly can be used to describe Hawking radiation. So the reason why I want to go to two dimensions is ultimately to motivate the use of these two-dimensional models to learn something for four-dimensional models. And the reason is that if you basically take a four-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action and coupled to a scalar field, and if you write the most generic spherically symmetric metric, so this is the first equation here, so this spherically symmetric ansatz. So we have a piece, GAB, which is the metric in the two-dimensional RT plane. And then we just have the metric for the two-sphere. So I have introduced here this factor exponential minus 2 phi. This is basically R squared, so the radius of these two spheres. And this dimensionful parameter lambda, just to keep track of the good dimensions. So if we do this, if you plug this ansatz into the action, we get basically this spherically symmetric reduction of the Einstein-Hilbert action. Now the point is that in two dimensions, we can look at what is called dilaton gravity. And dilaton gravity basically is a coupling of two-dimensional gravity with an additional scalar field, which we call this dilaton field. So this dilaton field is this phi here. So originally, these dilaton gravity theories were derived from string theory, basically. So they appear in many string theory computation. And so here, what I just would like to do is sort of de-emphasize the string theoretic origin of this dilaton gravity model and just emphasize the fact that I want to study this, and people have studied this, because it's really similar to the four-dimensional spherically symmetric action. And you can see that there are only minor differences between these two actions. So namely, the coefficients of these dilaton terms, and also the fact that here there is this cosmological constant term that here depends on the dilaton, and here does not depend on it. And very importantly, in the purely two-dimensional model, when we couple a scalar field here, I haven't put any, there's no coupling basically between this scalar field F and this dilaton. Whereas generically, in four dimensions, if you write the spherically symmetric metric, we get a coupling between the scalar field and the dilaton. This is going to be very important for what follows. So the point is that these 2D models have been extensively studied because even though we have these minor differences between 4D spherically symmetric and two-dimensional models, these two-dimensional models are still physically extremely rich. So in particular, they have black hole solutions, so these theories of 2D gravity, and these black holes, they Hawking radiate, basically. So they also evaporate. And so this has been studied extensively. So this is what people call the CGHS black hole. And so recently, basically, the reason for which I got interested into this is that I wanted to try to understand how we can generalize these results that were obtained in the two-dimensional CGHS black hole to generalize this to the four-dimensional spherically symmetric case. So the idea here is that we first focus on two-dimensional models and then try to see what we can transpose to the four-dimensional case and see what goes wrong when we try to go from two dimensions back to four dimensions. So now we're going to focus solely on two-dimensional models. Yeah, so this slide here is just to illustrate the fact that these two-dimensional dilaton gravity models, they are in fact exactly soluble. So we can write analytical solutions in closed forms. And in particular here, I have written the what would be an eternal black hole in this two-dimensional dilaton gravity. So if we go to a conformal gauge, and this we can do because we have a 2D metric, and we know that all the 2D metric are conformally equivalent. So I can take the 2D metric GAB and just write it as a conformal factor e to the 2 sigma times the flat 2D metric. And then if we go to light cone coordinates, x plus minus, the equations of motion coming from this 2D dilaton action reduce simply to this. We can find the explicit solution, where m here is a constant of integration. Then we compute the scalar curvature given by this solution. We can also reconstruct the metric. And we see that this scalar curvature is singular for some value of x plus x minus. So this precisely corresponds to a black hole where m would be here the mass of the black hole. And so just for terminology, usually people call the solution with m equals 0. So when this constant of integration is vanishing, this is then this scalar curvature is identically 0. And then the solution is just flat 2D Minkowski space. So we call this the linear dilaton vacuum. So now this was the solution with no matter action. And now what we can do is put some matter in this two-dimensional model. So put a non-zero energy momentum tensor. And for example, let us put just a single scalar field. So if you put a single scalar field, so the equations of motion are modified. Now this term is not zero anymore, but it's proportional to this component of the energy momentum tensor, the classical one. So in terms of the scalar field F, it's given by this. And now what we can do is study, in fact, the collapse of a null shell. So really the formation analytically of a black hole by the collapse of a null shell. So we choose this delta function spike here with amplitude alpha, which is sourcing this stress energy tensor, and which is coming only because of this delta here from scry minus right, basically. So like right moving modes. So we look at a black hole solution formed by the collapse of a right moving shell. Now we also have this equation of motion for the scalar field. And again, we can compute the solutions explicitly and analytically. The solutions are given by this now. Well, this is the contribution from this F wave, from this shock wave. Then again, we have a scalar curvature that we can compute. And in the region x greater than x0 plus, so after this shock wave, we again get a black hole solution, where now the mass of the black hole is lambda times this amplitude of the shock wave times x0 plus. And again, one can see that for x smaller than this point x0 plus, we get again the linear dilaton vacuum. So we have, if you want, this Penrose diagram here. So now the nice point is that this is all of space-time, because it's a two-dimensional model. So it's not like every point here is a two-sphere like it would be in four dimensions. This is the whole of space-time. So we have the coordinates, the light cone coordinates, x plus and x minus here. And here at some point, x plus 0, we send an F wave. Then this F wave is collapsing and forming eventually a black hole. And so what is nice is that now we can describe the Hawking properties of this black hole in the following way. So the idea is that we can use the trace anomaly to compute this Hawking radiation. So as I said, for a classical massless scalar field, so just from the point of view of this classical action, the trace of the energy momentum tensor is vanishing. This is just as a classical identity. But then quantum mechanically, in fact, the trace is not vanishing anymore. There is a one loop anomaly. And for example, if one computes this for n scalar fields, so here we can take n equals to 1, the expectation value of the trace is state independent and given simply by the 2D Ricci scalar. So that's the expectation value of the trace in two dimensions. So we have this this trace anomaly, this veil anomaly. But now the whole point is that because of the number of conservation equations for the energy momentum tensors in two dimensions, because we have to remember that one of these Wald axioms was that we require that the effective stress energy tensor has to be conserved. So we can just write the conservation equation for this effective stress energy tensor, then it reduces to this in these light cone coordinates. And we see that by integrating this conservation equation, we can explicitly reconstruct all of the components of the stress energy tensor. of this effective stress energy tensor. So this means that the knowledge of the trace anomaly enables us to compute explicitly all the components of the stress energy tensor. But now, as I said, there is an important difference between the trace anomaly and the other components of the effective stress energy tensor, which is that the trace anomaly is a local quantity and is state independent. So it's this value independently of the state that we choose to compute this expectation value. But for the full effective stress energy tensor, this is not true. This depends on the state. So we have to recover somehow the state dependency of this expectation value. And this is encoded in the fact that when we integrate this conservation equation, we have to specify some integration constants, or rather here, integration functions. And so basically, the choice of these boundary conditions or integration functions corresponds precisely to a choice of state. So I will explain in a minute how this works. So the statement is that from the knowledge of the trace anomaly, we can reconstruct explicitly the full stress energy tensor. And then we can just do this, for example, this simple calculation of Giddings and Nelson and compute the flux of the energy momentum tensor across scry plus right. So if I go to asymptotically flat null coordinates y minus, we can see that this flux, so this component of the flux, goes to this value. And so this corresponds precisely to a Hawking flux. And if we take the limit when y goes to infinity, we get a constant Hawking flux proportional to the number of scalar fields and a Hawking temperature given by h bar times lambda, which is this dimensionful parameter divided by 2 pi. So this means that at least qualitatively, these two-dimensional models describes really the formation of a black hole. And we can really look at an analytical solution and then analytically see the formation of this black hole. And then from the trace anomaly, we can reconstruct the full stress energy tensor, look at its component on scry plus, and see that there is a non-zero flux of Hawking radiation. So the only difference with the four-dimensional case is that in two dimensions, the Hawking temperature does not depend on the mass of the black hole, basically. That's just a minor difference. So now there is, in fact, another formalism to compute the effective stress energy tensor. And this other formalism is what we call the effective action. So the idea is that we're looking for an action, so for an effective action, gamma, which is such that its variation, so when we compute its energy momentum tensor, we get this effective stress energy tensor. And so heuristically, if you want, at least, this effective action can be obtained by integrating the trace anomaly, which we know in two dimensions. So this is strictly equivalent to integrating the conservation equations for the effective stress tensor, except that in four dimensions, one cannot simply integrate the conservation equations. So in four dimensions, the statement is that we have to use this effective action to determine the full effective stress tensor. This is why I want to introduce this method first in two dimensions. Because in four dimensions, it's the only thing that we can do. So if we do this here in two dimensions, if we functionally integrate this trace anomaly, basically, we get an effective action. And this is the so-called Polyakov action. And so you can see that this action is not local because of this 1 over box here. And this non-local nature of this effective action, so which in turn will lead to a non-local effective stress tensor, is precisely what is telling us that this stress tensor is state dependent. Because when we express this in terms of Green's function, we have to be more specific about the boundary conditions, basically. And this is encoding the state dependency of this effective stress tensor. OK, so let me just summarize what is going on with the choice of state here, because it's important. So the idea is that we have three possible choices, if you want. We just covered three possible ways of describing this effective stress tensor, or describing this Hawking radiation. So the first choice is to start from the classical energy momentum tensor, then choose a quantum state, and then choose whatever quantization and renormalization scheme that we want. For example, I don't know, let's say covariant point splitting, which is like which one can find in textbooks. Then we can compute this effective stress tensor. And for example, if you choose this light cone conformal frame, And if we choose positive frequency modes given by these light cone coordinates, then we get that the expectation value of the stress tensor in these so-called conformal states is given by this simple expression. So see, it only depends on sigma, which is this conformal factor here. So now what happens is that if one wants to change the quantum state, basically, so if one wants to take positive frequency modes, which are defined with respect to another coordinate here, so instead of being, say, the Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates for the black hole, it could be the Kruskal coordinates. So if you make a change of coordinates, one can show that this expectation value of the stress tensor gets an additional term, which is proportional to what we call the Schwarzian derivative of this change of coordinates, basically. And this Schwarzian derivative contribution is basically what is telling us how this effective stress tensor changes when we evaluate it in another state. So I'm going to give an example of this also in 1 minute. Now, the other point of view that I just give is that one can forget about this first method, just get the trace anomaly, then integrate the trace anomaly. Sorry, then use the trace anomaly to integrate the conservation equations. Because again, we require that the stress tensor be conserved at the quantum level. So I said that if we integrate the conservation equations, then we reconstruct the same stress tensor up to these functions that we are free to specify. So basically what happens here is that a choice of state, so we can evaluate this in different states here by choosing different normal modes, is encoded in this language in a choice of these functions here. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between the choice of these functions that we can freely specify and a choice of state for the evaluation of the effective stress tensor.
So you're choosing different coordinate systems, but the normal modes that go with this coordinate system are different. Is that because otherwise I don't understand.
Yeah. So so I'm just changing the normal modes. I'm not changing I can always freely specify the coordinates for these coordinates. But what is important here is that I don't change these coordinates. I change really the normal modes. This is what is going on here. And so the third point of view is that instead of integrating the conservation equations, if one knows the effective action, we can just derive the effective stress tensor from the effective action. And then again, when we compute this effective action, we are free to add a veil invariant part to this effective action. Because the only thing that we require from this effective action is that it reproduces the trace anomaly. So we can add terms that don't contribute to this trace. And one can see in two dimensions that these terms are precisely proportional to this function here, or these Schwarzian derivatives. So we know how to specify really a quantum state in this formalism. So for example, we can look at what happens in the case of the 2D Schwarzschild black hole. So I take this two-dimensional Schwarzschild metric, where now I choose this null frame, so these coordinates u and v. So these are these Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And then basically, usually in the literature, people use three types of physical states. Three type of sort of vacua, in fact. So the first one, which people call the Boulware vacuum, is defined by a choice of modes which corresponds to these coordinates, basically, u and v. So if we take these null coordinates and use these to construct these normal modes, then we get what we call the Boulware vacuum. And so in the Boulware vacuum, we can compute now the expectation value of the stress energy tensor, and we get basically this expression. So this is just some of the components, because also there's a trace component. But I don't want to crowd the slides, so I just put these components. And so basically, in the language of what I said on the previous slide, if one just integrates the conservation equations, we have these three functions to specify. And one gets the Boulware vacuum if we take these three functions to be equal to zero, basically. So this is this one-to-one correspondence between choice of normal modes, so choice of quantum state, and choice of these functions that we can specify. So the physical property of this Boulware vacuum is that it is not regular on the horizon. This is a property of this vacuum, of this Boulware vacuum. And the other property, basically the reason for which it was introduced, is that it's the natural notion asymptotically of Minkowski vacuum. So if you look asymptotically, when r goes to infinity, the expectation value of the stress tensor becomes zero. So we get empty Minkowski space at infinity. That's the physics of this Boulware vacuum.
Why does it
R would be like 2m, basically.
So why does it look regular there?
Yeah, in fact, to see how it's not regular, one should write it in Kruskal coordinates, in fact. So these coordinates, they oscillate a lot. If the normal modes in these coordinates oscillate a lot on the horizon. So these are not really adapted to looking at what happens near the horizon. And one can see explicitly the divergence if one was to rewrite this in just the Kruskal coordinates, for example. So we would have 1 over u, basically, and the horizon is defined by u equals 0, and then this blows up. Now, a more interesting state is the Hartle-Hawking Israel vacuum. So in this Hartle-Hawking Israel vacuum, we choose the ingoing and outgoing positive frequency modes to be defined with respect to the Kruskal coordinates, capital U and capital V. And so not these Eddington Finkenstein coordinates. And if we use this vacuum, then we can compute the expectation value of the trace energy tensor, and we get this quantity, basically. And again, this one-to-one correspondence between this choice of state and specifying this free function is given by this. If you choose the functions to be given by this, this is proportional to what I called earlier this Schwarzian derivative of this change of normal modes, then we get this expectation value. Now, the physics encoded in this stress energy tensor is that it is regular on the horizon now, but asymptotically, if we send R to infinity, this state is not empty, in fact. And this state is not empty, and it's a thermal state at Hawking temperature, in fact. So at infinity, this stress tensor is h bar over 768 pi m squared. So this is the thermal state at the Hawking temperature. So there is usually a third state that people look at, which is the Unruh state. And the Unruh state really describes the physics of a collapsing star, of a collapsing shell. But here, again, for the sake of simplicity, I don't want to discuss this state, because knowing these two states is enough for the discussion that comes now. So now I want to go to four dimensions and see what goes wrong if you try to apply this formalism to basically four-dimensional models. So here already, it's already very surprising, and this is why people, so these calculations are quite old, but people get excited about this a long time ago, because this reproduces very nicely all the, at least quantitatively, all the features of Hawking radiation that we expect in four dimensions. Although we are in a very simplistic two-dimensional model, which is completely soluble. So here we know the effective stress tensor explicitly for any state. So we can use this as a starting point for back reaction calculation. And people have looked at this very, very carefully. So the idea is that now if you want to go to four dimensions, does this procedure work again? And if it doesn't work, what fails? And how can we cure these problems? And if we can address this question in four dimensions, and if we can get to an effective stress tensor in four dimensions, then we can use this to address the problem of four-dimensional back reaction, basically. OK, so let's go back to four dimensions now. Unless you have. Yeah, sure, sure.
So in this effective action metric, you have to know the effective action for values of the metric other than the one that you really have.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so as you said, so what we really want is an effective action. So by construction, the effective action is an action. So it does not depend on the metric. And that's a very likable property, because then from this effective action, we get an effective stress tensor, which again does not depend on the geometry. So we can evaluate it in any geometry, any state.
But it does not depend on the metric?
No, I mean, it depends on the metric, but we can plug any metric we want.
Yeah.
It's not an object which is written in any specific metric. Yeah, this is why we can use it for back reaction, because we don't want to specify the metric. We want an object which is defined for any class of metric. So as you said, there is an ambiguity. And in two dimensions, essentially, this ambiguity in defining this effective action can completely be reabsorbed in this choice of two unknown functions that I wrote. So probably in four dimensions, it's going to be more explicit what this ambiguity is. So maybe I go to four dimensions.
Okay, maybe I'll raise the point again.
Yeah, sure.
I was suggesting that the further ambiguity.
So that you can add terms
but,
to this action, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, well that's.
So in 2D, we can add terms to this action. The only requirement is that these terms, when we compute the stress tensor, they don't contribute to the trace. Because the trace is fixed by some other independent calculation, we don't want to affect the trace. So we can show that any possible term that you can add to the action that will modify the rest of the stress tensor, but not the trace, can be written basically as these functions that I wrote. So this is the state dependency, basically, of this effective action. That is. No, in the action, it's like a cosmological constant, in fact. So it's like square root g times some constant parameter. So maybe, so please ask the question again. OK, so now we go back to four dimensions. And so if you remember the slide where I compared the four-dimensional action with the two-dimensional action, the property of the two-dimensional action is that for the matter part, so just for the action of the scalar field in the 2D metric, there was no coupling between the scalar field and the dilaton. So this term here was absent. This is why the trace anomaly that we got from this matter action was only dependent on geometric quantities, so just the metric, basically. So just the Ricci scalar of this 2D metric. Now, generically, in four dimensions, if you plug the spherically symmetric ansatz, generically what we get is a matter action which depends on the dilaton. Except that now, since we are in four dimensions, it's not really a dilaton field like in two dimensions. It's not an external scalar field. It's really a field related to the radius of these two spheres in this spherically symmetric coordinate. But still, this coupling is here. So there is this additional coupling between the scalar field and the gravitational degrees of freedom. And this will have important consequences. So basically, the important consequence is that if you compute the trace anomaly now for this scalar field action, so again, one gets a trace anomaly which is independent of the state, but which now contains additional dilaton contributions. So this is the trace anomaly which we get in the purely two-dimensional model, which we would get here if we neglected this coupling to the geometry here. But if we take into account this coupling, then generically we get these two additional terms.
This is under the assumption of spherical symmetry.
Exactly. So this effective action is this trace anomaly is for this effective action.
I don't understand. I mean, it's usually stated for spherical background in four dimensions, that the trace anomaly goes to the square root of the biotensor.
Yeah, exactly. It's not exactly four dimensions. So indeed, if I go back to the very first slide, in a full four-dimensional picture, the trace anomaly would be this very complicated object. So here it's four-dimensional, but spherically symmetric. So for this reason, the trace anomaly is much simpler than this, and it's just given by this. This is why there is no like Weyl tensor terms in here. That's the reason. No, but
basically you're depriving the scalar fields, all the fields of their degrees of freedom that conflict the spherical symmetry.
Exactly.
Only the Ricci scalar supplies within the Weyl field, isn't there a box R?
A box R? Here? No, there is. So again, I'm not showing how to derive this, but in fact, it was also debated how to derive it. Basically, people did not agree on this factor of six here. But it was like, basically it took 4 years between the first proposal. There's also a calculation by Hawking and Busso, which gets a wrong factor here, not six, but four. And it was corrected basically by Doker. So pretty much people agree on this value of the trace anomaly. So let's just take this face value and see what we can get from this. So the idea is that if we now look for an action, an effective action, which is such that its equations of motion gives us an effective stress tensor whose trace is this trace anomaly, this effective action takes this form, in fact. It's again a very non-local action. So there's this local part, this non-local term, and this non-local term. And again, this first non-local piece here is just the Polyakov action. So this first unlocal piece here is the contribution, if you want, from this R, which we had in the purely two-dimensional model. Now, because of these terms, we have these additional contributions. And so I call this effective action the anomaly-induced effective action, precisely for the reason that now there is a further ambiguity, and this is just the part of the effective action that agrees with this trace anomaly. So I call this just the anomaly-induced effective action. Yeah. No, sorry. Yeah. So I should say that. Yeah. What I didn't specify is that the motivation for studying this is twofold. Either we see this as a genuinely four-dimensional spherically symmetric action, in which case phi is related to R, or we can forget the 4D interpretation, see this as a really a two-dimensional dilaton gravity model, and there we're free to choose another action which has this coupling between the scalar field and the dilaton. So there, phi is another, is a completely independent degree of freedom. So this is why in here, I don't use the fact that R is e to the minus phi.
So if you take the four-dimensional point of view, what are the physical degrees of freedom?
The 2D metric, phi.
The four-dimensional point of view.
Yeah, so the RT plane metric and phi.
So phi is an independent. That's what I'm wondering. Is the theory of gravity plus a scalar field, or just the theory of gravity alone?
So what I'm saying is that there are two. This action appears in two theories. Either it appears in four-dimensional spherically symmetric, in which case G is the 2D metric and phi is part of the 4D metric, and F is a scalar field.
And how will you get Hawking radiation if it's pure gravity?
Oh, there's this scalar field, F here.
Oh, F. So what is F?
F is the scalar field.
F is the physical scalar field.
Oh, yeah.
Phi is the
dilaton. Yeah. In 4D, it might be, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Except that if I take the 2D point of view and see this now as just 2D dilaton with two scalar fields now, so with this dilaton scalar field and this F scalar field, then this is.
No, but if you go back to the four dimensional.
Yeah, then it might be that this is valid, yeah. I'm not sure, actually.
If it's not, then there's a worry that.
Yeah, yeah, but
really interested in the four-dimensional theory.
Sure. Yeah, so I agree. We should check whether this is, but intuitively, I would say that it is because. Yeah. So the point in four dimensions is that one cannot use this trick that we used in two dimensions. We cannot integrate the conservation equation because the 2D stress tensor, so this TAB, so again, AB are indices in the RT plane. Is not conserved in four dimension. The four-dimensional stress tensor is conserved, but this 2D part is not conserved. Therefore, we cannot use the conservation of the effective stress tensor to reconstruct all the components from the trace anomaly. So therefore, we have to use some notion of effective action. So people have tried to use this first anomaly-induced effective action, and what happens is the following. So we can look at the components of the stress tensor derived from this anomaly-induced effective action. I write it here in this conformal frame. And so basically, the components are given by the components that we had earlier in the purely 2D model, so contribution from the Polyakov action, plus these additional terms now. Now we can look at this in the two vacuum that we talked about earlier and see if it reproduces these features of Hawking radiation. So in the Bulwer vacuum, basically, we get these components for the stress tensor derived from this anomaly-induced effective action. So we see that we get an additional log term here, so which means that in addition to being, so this term here was already divergent, not regular on the horizon for the Bulwer vacuum. Here we get an additional contribution, which gives a further but milder divergence on the horizon. Then what we should check is that for m equals 0, when there's no mass, this should reduce to the Minkowski expectation value, so 0. So we can check here that indeed, if you use m equals 0, the expectation value is 0. So this means that at least From this point of view, Minkowski spacetime is a consistent solution of these semi-classical equations. So this has sort of the expected physical properties of the Bulwer state if we use this effective stress energy tensor. What goes wrong is when we look at the Hartle-Hawking-Israel state. And in this state, again, we can compute the expectation value here. The problem is that in addition, so this is the part that we would get from just the purely 2D contribution. This is the same term as we had from the Polyakov action, but now we have these additional pieces. So this piece here, plus something that I haven't written, which goes like 1 over r, basically. And these components are the same as for the Bulwer state. So this state is regular on the horizon, just like the as expected from this Hartle-Hawking state. But the problem is that when r goes to infinity, because there is this additional contribution here, the flux which we get of Hawking radiation is negative. There is this contribution here, which gives the 1, if you want, 1 over 768. And here we get minus 6 over 768. So we get a total flux of minus 5. So we get a negative flux of Hawking radiation. Then we can look also at the Unruh state. And for the Unruh state, it doesn't has the same peculiar behavior. We also get a negative flux of Hawking radiation. So this is quite problematic, in fact. We're really not happy with this feature, that we get this negative flux of Hawking radiation if we use this stress tensor obtained from this anomaly-induced effective action. And we can understand this by really taking the four-dimensional point of view. So as I said, what we should require is that the four-dimensional trace be local. And again, the reason is that in the full four-dimensional picture, so without spherical symmetry, there is also a trace anomaly. This trace anomaly is also state independent and is a local quantity. So we don't know, I don't know what this four-dimensional trace is, but it should be a local object. Now with spherical symmetry, we can look at what is this four-dimensional trace. So it's basically this two-dimensional trace plus this P, which is the tangential pressure, which is constructed from the spherical components of the 4D stress tensor. So by construction, the 2D trace is local, as we saw. This is given by the trace anomaly that we computed. So this is local. However, if we compute the tangential pressure for the effective action, which is induced by the anomaly, so for the anomaly-induced effective action, we get this tangential pressure. And this is a non-local object because of this 1 over box here. So said in a different language, if we take this tangential pressure and write it again in conformal null coordinates, we get this expression. And this is not invariant under a change of conformal frame. So therefore, we see sort of the same peculiar behavior. Either by looking at the flux of Hawking radiation, we get a negative flux with this effective stress tensor. And also, if you look at the 4D conservation, sorry, at the 4D trace, the full 4D trace is not local. And we would like the 4D trace to be local, in fact. So just all this to point out and to say that there seems to be a problem with this anomaly-induced action. And the problem is that there is a huge ambiguity in constructing this effective action. And the ambiguity comes from the fact that, in fact, the conformal anomaly determines only one part of the effective action. And it precisely only determines the part which is not veil invariant, so which gives a non-zero trace. But see, we can always add veil invariant terms to the effective action induced by the anomaly. So I call these contributions gamma zero. And these contributions, if they are veil invariant, they will have vanishing trace. So they will not affect the trace, as it should be, because we don't want to modify the trace anomaly. But they will contribute to the other components of the stress tensor. Therefore, they will contribute to Hawking radiation. So because there is this ambiguity in adding these veil invariant terms to the effective action, we can pretty much do like whatever we want with this effective action. So people have tried this. So there are several proposals for resolving this problem. And so I just want to focus on one of them. So this was a proposal by Mukhanov, Phipps, and Zelnikov. So it's quite old, in fact. But in this proposal, they had some physical motivation from finding what these veil invariant parts should look like. You can, like, can talk about it maybe later on, but I didn't write down this action because it's quite, it doesn't have a very nice form and it doesn't like speak too much. But what happens is that if one computes the expectation value of the stress tensor for this improved effective action, so by improved I mean the anomaly induced effective action plus these new violin invariant parts that we try to guess. So if we do this with the proposal of Mukanov, Phipps, and Zelnikov, what we get is this effective stress tensor. And we see that for Minkowski spacetime, when m is equal to 0, this is divergent. And it's also, in fact, divergent in regions in which the surface gravity vanishes, which exists, for example, in these, in the Reisner-Nordstrom black holes. This is a problem, because it means that with this proposal for the effective action that these people made, we get an effective stress tensor for which, like Minkowski spacetime, is not a solution of the effective Einstein equations. So this is quite problematic. So the question is whether we can sort of go back and find first principles to derive this effective action. Yeah.
So maybe this is a good time to ask you going back to first principles. Is this effective action for a particular region of space-time? Does it include what's inside the black hole? Is it done by analytic continuation with rotation?
Yeah, indeed, it might be the case. Yeah, and I don't think people have looked at really what happens with the black hole. So if we try to tell this effective action and we derive it that there is a black hole boundary, I don't think people have discussed this. But yeah, indeed, one might want to look at this.
So they're doing it under the assumption of asymptotically
flat, exactly.
No horizon.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So the problem here is that we have this typical situation where we like.
But you want to apply it where there is a black hole.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. So indeed, there might be like a subtlety related to the fact. So there are many proposals in the literature for modifying this effective action, and none of them are like physically convincing because of this. So it's always like if you modify one thing, then something else goes wrong. Basically, if you try to like add terms to get a positive flux of Hawking radiation, then Minkowski spacetime is not a solution anymore. Mm-hmm. Typically,
saying that the 4D Hawking radiation plus kind of engine temps cannot be derived. I mean, the correct one cannot be derived from a effective action.
Well, I would like to claim that it can. So that's the last part of the. This is the what I would like to test now and talk about. Because this is rather unsatisfactory. So this has been left aside for a long time, almost for 10 years, because I think people got discouraged, because they thought that only thing we can do is add terms by hand, and we never found anything like satisfactory. So the question is whether there is still something satisfactory to do. Well, maybe I should have put a pause here. But so the idea is that there is this proposal for computing the one-loop effective action, in fact, given by the action for the matter field in spherical symmetry. So what we can do, so it's take the action for this 2D scalar field coupled to the dilaton, do this field redefinition, and do this field redefinition so that we have this sort of more convenient form of the action. Then with this form of the action, we can compute the Hessian and get this differential operator here. And there is this formalism, so De Witt and then Barvinsky and Wilkowski, which apparently tells us how to compute the one-loop effective action, so given this classical action. And basically, this one-loop effective action is given by this proper time integral of the trace of the heat kernel, where the trace of the heat kernel is defined in this way. So this is just the functional trace here. And this trace here is the trace on over any like internal degrees of freedom. And the heat kernel here, this Ks, xy is a solution of this heat equation, basically, with these like initial conditions. And so basically, in this formalism, the reason for which these people introduced this formalism is that it is manifestly covariant, and it works for any like arbitrary background. We never have to specify what the background is, which is what we want to get this effective action and the effective stress tensor. And also, quite importantly, or maybe not so importantly, but it's a nice feature, is that it's not based on the trace anomaly. So one does not have to know already from some other calculation what the trace anomaly is, because the trace anomaly comes, in fact, as a byproduct of this calculation of the one loop effective action. So the problem is basically how to compute this trace of the heat kernel.
Now you have that and we've got it, is that
right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the whole question now that was addressed by these people is how to compute the trace of this heat kernel. So apparently, if we introduce this new differential operator and introduce this sort of generalized curvature objects, so these would be, so these R's are all the objects that encode the 2D geometry. So it would be this operator Q and also the 2D Ricci tensor. But since it's the 2D Ricci tensor, the Ricci tensor in 2D is just proportional to 1/2 of R times the metric GAB. So we can just replace RAB by R and this Q. So this is just a notation. And so basically, there is apparently in the literature this expression for the trace of the heat kernel expanded in curvature invariants. And so up to order 4 in curvature invariants, this is the expression for this heat kernel. So there are all these terms, some over 5 terms here, 29 terms here. And all these depend on these form factors, alpha I. So this is a curvature invariant of order 2. So some contraction of these objects. And this is some invariant of order 3. So these people have listed like all these invariants and computed this. So basically, one of these papers is 176 pages. And it has like quite horrible expressions. But one can still like get some things out of it. And OK, so the point is that we can write the trace of this heat kernel in this two-dimensional model. And lots of things simplify because we have this symmetry, basically, because the Ricci tensor can be expressed just as a function of the Ricci scalar. So because of this, some of these form factors are vanishing. There are many like terms that cancel in this action. And then we just have to basically address the question of the behavior of this proper time integral. Because the idea is to integrate this trace of the heat kernel from S going to 0 to infinity. So people have derived also the late proper time behavior of these form factors. And if one looks at the behavior of these form factors for S going to infinity, one can see that 1 over S times trace of the heat kernel behaves like 1 over S squared. So in this sense, the integral over S going from 0 to infinity is convergent at the upper bound. So in this sense, people say that this proper time integral is infrared finite. So then, aside from this infrared finiteness, there is still a UV problem. And in fact, one can show that the effective action that we get from integrating the trace of this heat kernel can be written as a sum of two parts. One part is exactly this anomaly-induced effective action that I wrote earlier. And this part, in fact, comes from just a simple fact, which is that in this trace of heat kernel, there is a total term that appears as a total derivative in S. Therefore, this integral over S simplifies, and this gives this finite part, which is not divergent, does not need to be regularized, and which is exactly this anomaly-induced action. Then there is a remaining part, which I call gamma mu. And this remaining part is basically UV divergent, and one needs to put like a cutoff when S goes to 0 to regularize this integral. So we can do this, in fact. And the upshot of the calculation is this. We get that the full one-loop effective action is given by the sum of these three terms. So first, there is this anomaly-induced effective action. Then there is an action which is a contribution of order 2 in curvature, then a contribution of order 3. And then this calculation basically stopped at order 3. And so these are these contribution to the effective action. So this part, again, is the anomaly-induced effective action. So this is what people have already guessed from just integrating the trace anomaly. So this is the contribution which, when we compute the stress energy tensor and compute its trace, we get the trace anomaly. Then these two contributions are a Weyl invariant. And one can check this in the sense that if you compute the stress energy tensor coming from this contribution, compute its trace, the trace is 0. So this does not modify the trace anomaly as it should be. Okay, 3 minutes. Yeah, so this is just the fact that these bugs act on different points, and then so this guy is acting on here, then this bug's acting on this phi. And then we make all the points coincidence, basically. So this is, yeah, this is, Yeah, this is extremely formal, so we have to define this. So these are basically like mass spectral integrals, right? And so I just want to show that even though this is really formal, you can exactly compute something out of this by just putting Green's function here. And so that's just the last slide. So now that you have this proposal for this one loop effective action, one can address, again, trying to address this problem, compute the effective stress tensor, and see if it has the properties that we want. So if you look at the RT-plane components of the stress tensor, so just AB, would be these RT-plane components, we already know what the stress tensor is, the contribution for the anomaly-induced action. So for this first action here, because this was computed like quite a while ago. So the question here is, what is the contribution from the other part of the effective action? So these I call T2 and T3. So the first thing that one can check is that, as I said, these contributions are indeed conformally invariant, which means that their trace is zero, so they don't modify the trace anomaly. And this is like the first thing that we should require. So this is satisfied. And then we can compute this effective stress tensor. And I don't want to just want to flash it because it's quite horrible, but that's the result, basically. So we can express everything in terms of like massless or massive retarded Green's function. And the idea is that just to show how we can give a meaning to this, if we compute the tangential pressure, we can go again to this conformally flat gauge, use this retarded Green's function, and compute explicitly the tangential pressure. So all this issue of like having log of box and log of box over box, and also this UV. So this illustrates the fact that we can really deal with this UV cutoff mu. So there is no more mu dependence here. So for the tangential pressure, we get this like expression. So which is complicated, which we would have to compute numerically. So I'm not sure what the properties of this tangential pressure are, but at least we can really get the effective stress tensor out of this effective action. Okay, so to summarize what we did, so we saw that the 2D models are quite robust and useful, in fact, in the sense that in two dimensions, we know the trace anomaly. From this trace anomaly, we can reconstruct the full stress tensor. One way to get the stress tensor is to reconstruct the effective action from the trace anomaly. And once we do this, we get quite good description of Hawking radiation. So therefore, this means that the two-dimensional effective stress tensor that we derive from this effective action is indeed a good starting point to compute compute back reaction. Now the point is that if we want to improve this 2D model and include backscattering, so backscattering is precisely this coupling between the scalar field and the dilaton, or if we want to treat the 4D case, which for spherically symmetric metrics typically has this coupling between the scalar field F and the dilaton phi, then we need to take into account this coupling. And then the problem that we saw is that the trace anomaly for the scalar field and the dilaton is known, but the naive effective action that we can reconstruct from this trace anomaly fails in the sense that it gives us an effective stress tensor, which doesn't have the good physical properties. What we saw also is that there is a way, in fact, to get the correct violin-invariant parts of the effective action, or when I say correct, rather it's just a hope at this point. So I hope that these new violin-invariant parts are the correct ones. So to show this, one would have to study very precisely what this new effective stress tensor that I have written is, study the properties of the tangential pressure. Then we have to ask if Minkowski vacuum is a consistent solution of the back reaction equations. We have to ask if the trace, the 4D trace, computed from these two new effective tangential pressure and stress tensor is local. Then we also have to change the normal modes and write this effective stress tensor in any state. Once we can have the Hartle-Hawking state, we have to see if the flux of Hawking radiation is positive. And then maybe we can use some numerical techniques and compute the back reaction. But at least the new statement here is that there is this proposal now for this new effective action for 4D spherically symmetric models. So we just have to study its properties and see if we can use it for back reaction. Okay, thank you.
So any preliminary results on that?
Well, unfortunately. So I was hoping that the end result would be simpler, but it's a bit too complicated. So I think I need like numerical stuff to see. Yeah, so this is still 2D. So basically what they have is a way to compute this green function and in a black hole geometry and all these things. So I should like look at what they did.
Okay. Well, so in 4D, there's a spatial geometry. The perturbation metal tensor is not known analytically, but it can be calculated using those sums. And Visser came up with a analytic expression for the answer is accurate to 1% in comparison to the numerical calculation. Now, so at least for scalar field, the in the social background, the perturbation of the tensor is essentially known.
Yeah. No, so for sure. So as you said,
of course, that derivation does not involve any effective action.
Yeah. So yeah, as you said, so this thing has been studied like extensively. So typically, stress energy tensor for all types of matter fields on the Schwarzschild geometry. So indeed, if I like can give a more precise meaning to this effective stress tensor, I would have to compare what I get to calculations that already exist. But the motivation for doing this is that I want an effective stress tensor which does not depend on the geometry, so that I can use it for back reaction. Because these stress tensors that are computed for a Schwarzschild geometry, we cannot use this for back reaction. Because it has.
What do you mean? I mean, the back reaction,
yeah, but that's for a fixed background, right?
Pardon?
That's for a fixed background, right?
Well, yeah, for a fixed, you know, for the sport field.
Yeah.
Now you can plug that back in to the Einstein equation and calculate the correction.
Exactly.
I did that.
Yeah.
In the early 80s, 81. But, and find that the metric stays working through the approximation. So I'm not quite sure how useful to do is. I mean, is it going to take be able to derive new results? I mean, I'm not too optimistic to be able to get analytic expressions.
Yeah, I'm not too optimistic either. But the first thing is I wanted to see if we can just resolve this issue of knowing the effective action, the one-loop effective action. And yeah, so as I said, this is also like would be a starting point for the 2D back reaction with backscattering, in fact. Because for backscattering, we need this coupling between this additional coupling to the scalar field. And so there, for example, this calculation from 2010 of Ashtekar, Pretorius, and Ramazanoglu are, I'm not sure in detail how they work, but I think they, at least they claim that they're like much more precise than what has been done so far. And for this, they needed like the full stress tensor, like geometry independent, and be able to plug any geometry in it, basically. This was required. This was, in fact, my original motivation. See how I can apply this generalized to the 4D case. So the first question that I ask is whether we can get the generic, like, effective stress tensor in 4D.
Yeah.
Yeah, perturbatively in fire.
Yeah.
I would be tempted to say that this has been done, because on this topic, pretty much everything has been at least attempted. So I don't know the calculation, but it probably can be done. And
in 4D, the knob scattering limit is generally calculated.
Because then it's just the 2D stuff. So, but there's a precise sense in which in 4D, 4D without backscattering is less natural than 2D without backscattering. In the sense that in 2D, if you want to just couple a scalar field, you just put a scalar field, basically. Whereas in 4D, if you want to put a scalar field, you generically get this coupling to phi, basically. So indeed, people have, you could do like, because from the 2D point of view, we have the Polyakov effective action. From this, we can get an effective stress tensor in which we can plug any geometry. So people have done, in fact, also back reaction calculations in 4D with this effective stress tensor coming from the Polyakov action. But they were just not satisfied with it, because these two things come from two different like schemes, basically. One of them is 4D spherically symmetric, and the other one is the action coming from genuinely 2D model. This is why people like basically try to generalize this to something that's more general.
Among your tests, did you say that you want to reproduce the four-dimensional, the second one, the third one?
Mm-hmm.
You say it should be local, but do you want it to actually be, one knows the expression for the space phenomenon in four dimensions. So do you want it to be literally that expression?
Yeah, but I would have to take this expression and write it in spherical symmetry, and I'm not sure what this is. So yeah, I haven't done this calculation, but maybe it should be compared to this indeed, yeah. So take the full general 4D trace anomaly.
Yeah, specialize it to the spherical.
Yeah.
Is it your point of view that they should agree? I mean, it's just not.
Yeah, they should agree, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Then presumably you would not see them.
Yeah.
I mean,
no. So this. Yeah. So this is why there are two issues, right? One issue is like identical, like I would say, identity between the 4D trace spherical symmetry and the 4D trace reconstructed from these objects. And a weaker statement would be just to say that the 4D trace reconstructed from this object, even if it does not agree with the other expected 4D trace, is at least local, because that. Oh, because I want it to be state, so that it is state independent, in fact. Because if it is non-local, then this is not just vacuum polarization. It's like really like a massless mode. And this, if it's not local, it depends on the state.
I see, but I mean, if it's not the right 4D anomaly, how do we know what it should be?
No, I agree. But I just want, maybe, I don't know, I want to see if maybe it's a reasonable physical input to say that we want the 4D trace anomaly to be local. I don't know if that's reasonable enough, but at least maybe we can use this as a criterion.
I mean, the 4D trace anomaly on spectral background, its calculation does involve modes of perturbations, quantum perturbations on that background.
You mean other than S waves are?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It includes all monopoles, and of course, it's done this in a radical calculation, not a metallic calculation.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, but again, it's like whether one does like beyond S wave, and then we can only do things numerically, or we do S wave and we try to.
This is believe, you're supposed to be believable. It has to come up with the same Chris anomaly that there's no kind of for social pattern.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So one last question, then
the second half, but someone else.
But why does it share on the vision from information products?
Of information products, honestly, so far there's no new input, no new answer. Because I think that to shed new light on information paradox, one would need to do a back reaction, right? Yeah, but back reaction is like way beyond this. I mean, first, this is like the step zero of back reaction. But so in the CGHS, for example, with this like enhanced like numerical simulation, people have made like new statements about like unitarity and information loss and things like this. But for this, they needed to compute like the full back reaction. So for example, one thing that they saw is that usually like Hawking scenario assumes that like space-time remains like asymptotically flat all throughout like evaporation. So this, I think, they confirmed. Then one statement usually made is that the Bondi mass decreases little by little until it reaches some like Planck scale Bondi mass. What they saw is that the naive Bondi mass becomes negative, in fact. And it's because the Bondi mass is usually defined, like imported from like a classical definition. So they had like to add some like quantum contributions to this and define this new, like, I think they call it like Ashtekar, Tavras, Varadarajan, like Bondi mass. Things like this. And they also claim that if one does some, like, I don't know in which sense, but some quantum gravity extension of the very last stage of the evaporation, then there is no information loss because you get a complete space-time at the end of But this is based on, like, additional, you know, quantum gravity inputs and But I don't want to speak for anyone who's not here. But.
All right. If you have any more questions, then you can also discuss with Mark personally, of course. So let's thank Mark again.